Greetings, EastEnders fans, and a very Merry Christmas to you. And what a Christmas present we have for you. So, a few months ago now, we filmed an interview, a two-part interview, no less, with the one and only Chris Clenshaw, previous executive producer of EastEnders. Didn't we, Ree?
We did indeed. It was so good. It was so... We were in awe, weren't we?
Honestly,
like,
he's great.
What?
It's absolutely
amazing.
Great, as if we spoke to Chris Clenshaw. And we've been holding on to it. We thought, when do we release this? And then we thought Christmas, that's the perfect opportunity to give you a fabulous Christmas present from us. So like I say, this interview is in two parts. You'll get the second episode at another point in this week. So the first part, he's talking about being an executive producer, how he got the job of executive producer, and those first few months on the show, including Cindy's return. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a wonderful interview with the one and only Chris Clenshaw. So, I can't quite believe I'm saying this, but Chris Clenshaw, welcome to Albert Square After Dark.
Ah, oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for doing this. Look, Ree, it's Chris Clenshaw. Can you believe this?
I know, I can't believe it.
No, honestly, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to speak with you both. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. How are you, first of all?
I'm good. I'm really good, thank you. Yeah, it's been... So I left EastEnders... I left about 6 months ago after the 40th, although I was still across all of my episodes until June. So I was still going back to Elstree once a week and signing off episodes. I was still signing off everything remotely. So I don't think I really detached myself from the show until kind of early July. And even then, you know, I'm still watching. I love the show. I can't not watch. A lot of people keep saying to me, "Oh, maybe you shouldn't watch," because, and I was like, "How can I not? I love it." So, I'm very well. I'm getting a lot more sleep.
I bet. I mean, well, this is the thing, first of all, isn't it? You are a fan of the show. You're like the show's biggest fan in the world. Can you talk us through sort of the beginning of your relationship with EastEnders in terms of a viewer?
Yeah. I don't have like a first memory or anything like that. I think it's because I'd quite literally been watching since birth. There's like photographic evidence of my twin sister and I in our baby bouncers in front of the old school, you know, box TV, the huge boxes that we used to have, watching EastEnders. And, you know, my mum religiously watched both Coronation Street and EastEnders, and she still does. And it was a ritual in our house. Every evening we would sit down and watch as a family both those soaps. And while I really enjoyed Corrie, I loved EastEnders. And I think it's because I feel like I've always had an affinity to the show. I'm from Southeast London. My dad's a market trader. My mum ran a greasy spoon. My dad's like a proper Del Boy character. He's very like Alfie Moon, actually. Although my mum's not like Cat Slater.
What a shame.
Kill me if I compared her to Cat Slater. I worked with my dad on the market from like the age of 13 to about 21, every Saturday, all through the school holidays. There was a pub in the middle of the market. This is
We're talking
about Woodbridge Market in Southeast London. The pub used to open at 6 o'clock for the traders, for the market traders. So I, as a 13-year-old lad, would be there at 6 a.m. doing a coffee run while everyone else was queuing up to kind of go and have their first beer of the day. So I always felt like I knew the characters. I felt like they sounded like me. I felt like, you know, we were from the same walk of life or from the same world. And I think that aside, or on top of that, I was always more drawn to EastEnders because I think of its grittiness. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, that I felt like if I'm comparing it to Coronation Street, because I would watch them both growing up, I just felt that there were heavier storylines. You know, I remember being in shock, you know, watching Nick Cotton, go cold turkey when Dot had to lock him in his room. And yeah. I think I was young at the time, you know, I'm going to show my age, but I think I look back and I'm like, I was about five. And, you know, we would often be at EastEnders story conferences and we'd be talking about something and I'd be like, how can I remember that? And I realized I was four, but it's because I've always watched it. And I don't know if anyone remembers this, but for the 10th anniversary, the BBC put on repeats of the very first episodes at 6 a.m. every morning, and it was half
Wow.
term. So like that February half term. So while I was about 10, not even 10 years old, I think about nine or 10 maybe, I was watching the show. So what were we in the mid, 95, and I would get up in that half term and then watch the very first episode. So I was able to kind of like fill in a lot of my
Wow.
knowledge. And you know, and yeah, and and just going back to the storylines, I think like the Nick thing always sticks really vividly in my mind for some reason. I think it was just so harrowing and really well portrayed and
Yeah.
performed. And you know, June was phenomenal. And but then other storylines like Steve Owen and Matthew Rose killing Saskia and burying her in Epping Forest, like
Yeah.
that will always like haunt me. Or like, and Ethel's euthanasia is also a story that like
Oh.
that's probably one of
Oh.
my very favorite episodes.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know if I've answered your question, but I've
Pretty, yeah, you have. That's a good answer. I mean, yeah,
yeah.
those early memories just stick in your head, don't they? I've got a, I remember Sharongate. I don't remember the reveal in the pub, but I remember watching Phil and Grant have that fight in the Archers.
When he went
Like
in the
those,
pit.
yeah, those
Oh,
things that just stick in your head.
yeah.
So huge fan, obsessive fan by the sound of things. So how do you go from fan to working for the show and thereby climbing up to executive producer?
Well, that's a great question. How do I do it? So I was working in unscripted for, you know, several years before I kind of made that leap over. And I think it's quite it's not unheard of, but it's quite an unconventional journey, or quite an, you don't often get many people that are able to, that go from one, go from scripted to unscripted, or vice versa, really. But so I had a career in unscripted, and I was at ITV for 5 years. I was, you know, I started as a runner on Richard and Judy. Remember the Channel 4 show?
Yes. Yeah.
And
Book
I,
club.
yes, Richard and Judy Book Club. So it was Cactus TV was the production company. So I worked on Richard and Judy as a runner, and Saturday Kitchen as well, because they also produced that and still do. And then I was I did several jobs that I did as a researcher. I did like cookery shows, music shows, some light entertainment shows, some studio shows, and I ultimately ended up at ITV, where I was a researcher on This Morning, and I ended up staying at ITV for about 5 years, and I'd had various roles on This Morning, but I'd pretty much gone from researcher to producer in those 5 years. And it got to a point where I felt like I needed to kind of break free, or to kind of move on from This Morning. I realized that I was I was I'd gotten everything that I could get out of it, I'd got from it. And
Good.
I had kind of two I was very fortunate, and I had two opportunities, and one was to go and produce Good Morning Britain, and one was to go and produce Big Brother's Bit on the Side with Rylan. And I had been working with Rylan in the hub on This Morning, so I knew him really well. And but the it would have been a very comfortable move to stay at ITV. I would have kept my staff position, whereas I took the risk and went into the freelance world, because obviously Big Brother's you're kind of contracted by a series, and obviously a series is only X many weeks. So I'd signed up to do the civilian series, followed by the celebrity series, which was a little later on in the year. There was a couple of weeks break, I think, between the two of them. But because I'd done that, because I'd made that decision to work on Big Brother and go freelance, I was therefore always, at the time, I was constantly keeping a look on the job site. So I was, because I knew that I'd be have to find another job soon. I stumbled across what can only be described, and even at the time, was like a job that I don't know if I even realized existed. It was like my dream job, and it was a junior trainee storyliner.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I couldn't
Wow.
believe my eyes. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to apply for this. And you didn't need any experience in drama or scripted. And yeah, so I was like, I've got to kind of go for this. And so Dominic Treadwell Collins was the exec at the time. Alex Lamb was the story producer. And it was you know, quite an intense, arduous process. There were over 650 applicants.
I bet.
They whittled down to, I'm not entirely sure how many actually. And we had to do a writing sample about who your favorite character was. And I basically wrote all about my dad and how he's basically Alfie Moon. And from that, they invited, I want to say, about 30 of us to Elstree. And I remember arriving, and we had to do a pitch. And I remember arriving, and we were put in the kind of bar canteen area. And I remember getting there thinking, I've not got a chance in hell of getting this. There were script writers there. There was a lot of incredibly talented people that I felt had so much more experience in this field than I did. And we had to pitch a 3-minute story. So you came with that pitch to each other in the room in a very kind of similar way that you run a EastEnders story conference. And then half of us were basically through to the afternoon session, and half were kind of thanked and sent on their way. It sounds like
It sounds
something
like the
out
X Factor.
of or The Hunger Games. And
Yeah.
then, so then the final 15, I think it was about 12, 15 of us. We then, as a group, storylined the next three episodes. So picking up what from last night's on-screen episode. So we knew what had happened last night on screen because we'd obviously all watched it, or you'd hoped everyone had watched it. And
Yeah.
we threw it around and storylined those three episodes, really like rough shape, but in a very similar way to that you work in the story office. And then you were sent away, and I think you had 24 hours to write up those three episodes, in the house style and deliver. And I really enjoyed it. I loved it. And I then went back to Big Brother and thought, I'm never gonna hear that. I'm never gonna hear from them again. And a few weeks later, I got the call to tell me that I'd got the job, and I couldn't believe it. And it was, yeah, it was. And I don't know if it's how it sounds, but it sounds a bit of a cliche, a bit tacky, but it was a dream come true. And
It sounds amazing.
it was a bit of
Yeah.
a, well, it was a quite a big step back, really. I'd been, it was the first rung of the ladder. In scripted, in first rung of the ladder at EastEnders, the most junior person in the editorial department. I was producing in entertainment. I remember I'd not long been on the property ladder. I just got a mortgage, and so it was pay cut. And I was like, oh my gosh, can I do this? But there was never a chance that I was, even though all those things were going through my mind.
Yeah.
There was never a chance that I was going to like let this opportunity pass me by. So then I joined EastEnders. I did a 9-month traineeship under Alex, who was phenomenal, and I learned so much from him. I learned so much from Dom. I then was a storyliner. I then went and script edited for a period of time. That was while Sean O'Connor was in charge. I then returned to the story team when John York came in. John York came in as creative exec. Was that his position? Anyway,
Something like that, yeah.
thing.
Consultant producer or something like that during that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I went back to the story office as story editor, and then John very quickly made me the story producer. So within 2.5 years, I'd gone from being the kind of most junior person in the room to running the story office and being in charge of the story office and
Wow.
the story department. And then I did that for a year. Just over it. Was it just over a year? About a year. And then I got a job as a producer on Holby, and I did that for just over a year. And then I left Holby. I left the BBC to work in high-end drama. So I spent a few years away from the BBC. I was working for Vertigo Films. I was developing a drama for Sky with them. I was then working in development for Rope Ladder Fiction. And I was going into production on a BBC show with Rope Ladder Fiction. When the call came in asking if I wanted to interview for the exec producer job, and I suppose, they that was again quite a intense process
I bet.
and a lengthy process, but yeah, I suppose the rest is history, really. And that's
Yeah.
yeah, I was
Yeah.
very very fortunate and got that position as exec producer, and that was begin. I took that was obviously the end of 2021, started in 2022, and yeah.
That's what they say.
So, what does the role of executive producer actually entail then on EastEnders? Because some of us, might not know exactly all the details of it.
So the role as exec can change depending on the show, depending on the production,
Yeah.
and I think it can also be significantly different when it comes to film. So there is quite a difference sometimes. But on a show like EastEnders, I think you're what's also referred to as the showrunner, or I think in sim even in simple terms, you're kind of the boss. You're the captain of the
Yeah.
ship, or
Yeah.
as Steve McFadden calls me, he calls me Jen Clenn, or General Clenshaw, head of the army. So
Oh,
you
I
are,
like
it's a
that.
very nice title. So you have ultimate authority overseeing the entire production's creative vision, strategy. You're effectively the CEO of the production. You lead and manage the company by setting its overall strategic and creative vision and the direction, overseeing all aspects of operations, fostering the right work culture, and importantly, being accountable. You're accountable for every decision. You're accountable at every
Yeah.
you're accountable for everything that happens off screen, and therefore everything that then makes it to screen. And I think it's to kind of sum it up, I think you make the final decisions and sign off on
Yeah.
everything. So while also leading the production and the cast and the crew, you're empowering everybody to do their jobs to the best of their
Yeah.
ability, and but to the standard that's set by the exec producer. And I think to be like even more specific on that, the exec's responsible for every editorial decision throughout the process. You have the final sign off on storylines, scripts, casting, costume design, as I say, design, through to like post-production. And you obviously work very closely with your heads of department, whether that's the line producer, and to ensure that you're managing the budget effectively, or whether it's your production designer to ensure that you're that the future sets that the future sets that they're designing on your behalf are to the vision that you have set out, or it's working with the head of communications on the press strategy, or it's working with the head of casting on the casting director on any kind of new or returning characters that you're creating or that you're hoping to bring in. And it's a beast of a show, and it's a very well-oiled machine, as I'm sure you can imagine. It's been
Yeah.
a couple of years, and every member of the crew is a master at what they do day in, day out. They are experts and geniuses, and what the exec does is kind of leads that and sets the tone to some degree, like obviously the tone of the show, but also the tone of the workplace.
Work
And
culture,
yeah, absolutely, the work culture. And I think if that alchemy is right, then the team and the crew and everyone, and there's just shy of like 500 people, they can then fly and do their job to the best of their ability. So yeah, that does that. I don't know if I've kind of given you a very
It's a
long.
lot of accountability, I think, for you.
Yeah.
Like, you're
Yeah.
accountable for every element of the show, behind the scenes, on screens.
The buck stops with you. So whether it's
Yeah.
success or whether it's a failure, you're making a show for the viewers. It's their show. I always said that. I know that some viewers would not agree with certain decisions, and that's always going to be the case. I don't know if you're ever able to please everyone, although you try. But the exec's got to kind of take that responsibility. So you take you on behalf of the audience, you're making the show, but then at the same time, you've also got I felt the weight of the production on your shoulders, in terms of the it's you want to keep the show in a really healthy place and succeed, so that everyone can kind of do their best. That
Yeah.
makes
I think you definitely, you achieved that, Chris.
As long as
Don't
you never
worry, I think
slept.
it's safe to
That's very
say.
kind.
Yeah,
Thank you.
exactly. So
Thank
when
you.
you
I hope
did
so.
first take on this role of executive producer, did you have a main creative aim or mission for the show? Did you have anything in mind as soon as you got
That's
that
a great
role?
question. Yeah, great. That's a really great question. Yeah, I did. I did. I had to. I think my kind of aim, my plan, my vision, whatever you kind of want to call it, was to I really wanted to kind of give EastEnders its heart, its East End spirit, and its soul back. And I had a kind of, I don't even know if many people know this. No, a few those that were in kind of close proximity to me do, and the BBC did. But I had a kind of what I believe was a clear three-step strategy to achieve that. And the first one, it's going to sound a bit, I don't know, a bit smug maybe, but it was. I felt that it was quite a quick fix in terms of to make EastEnders EastEnders again. And it was to honour the DNA, you know, honour the DNA of the show that Julia and Tony had very clearly established all of those years ago. But it was also to ensure that it looked, that it felt, that it smelled like EastEnders. And there's a grammar to the show that you wouldn't even, or you shouldn't be aware of, I think, when you watch an episode. But I also think that you pick up on it and you are aware of it, or you notice it when it's not being adhered to.
100%, yeah.
And it's
Yes,
about, and there's
definitely.
so many things that kind of play into that. You know, it's about story and it's about structure, and not just long-term stories, but how one episode is built or constructed and how that develops and how that develops even just across a week. And I used to say to directors a lot that now with everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people watching in one chunk. Some people watch the whole, like I know my sister does it. She'll watch Monday to Thursday, 2 hours on a weekend or something when she's got some time late at night once the kids are in bed.
Omnibus.
Like an omnibus, yeah. But I think, you know, we've got a much more kind of bingey culture now with our consumption, and because of there's
Definitely.
so much of available, so much content available. So not everybody watches like that, but I remember saying to a lot of directors that with that in mind, you almost want to give them a different experience each episode to some degree. Not that they should never necessarily kind of pick up on it, but you know, maybe you know, there's not necessarily a formula, but at the same time, you don't want it to feel predictable, or you don't want it to feel formulaic. So, but I suppose what I'm getting to is, like on a Monday, for example, and this isn't an average, this isn't a kind of every week this wasn't the shape at all, but Monday you might have more stories, you might have four stories running, and you might feel much more, it might be a quicker pace, and there might be a much bigger community spirit. And by the time you got to Thursday, you might only be focusing on one or two of those stories, and it might, because you're kind of built, you're always building, not every week, but you're always building to these, you know, big tentpole moments in that story, whether it's the huge denouement or just the kind of midpoint of the longer arc across the year. And therefore you want to maybe focus on them, or you want to give them the space and the time that they deserve, or tonally you don't want them to clash against something else. So therefore by the time you get to Thursday and it may be, you know, more focused and only playing one or two storylines, you've got a slower pace. And therefore when you, and I would do my exec reviews, I would do them in one chunk, a bit like I'm just saying, some people now watch. So I would also, I'm the first viewer, like I'm the first person that gets to see this almost finished product when the director presents it back to me. So we've gone through the whole process from story to script to the director coming on board. Like, so we do three drafts of story, you do five drafts of scripts, you then go into pre-prep, then the director comes on board at kind of draft four, although they've read the third draft of the script. I have a big tonal meeting with the director and the script editor and the series producer, and that's kind of our opportunity for me to kind of explain what we're looking for from the block. And then they go into a prep, couple of weeks prep before they start shooting. And then I would often have another meeting with the director for them to, now they're in their prep, they know how they're going to shoot it. They know what's kind of been thrown up in prep, any kind of problems, any creative ideas that they've had, anything they want to do that's slightly out of the ordinary, for them to kind of pitch back to me and for me to have that discussion with them. And then you go through the shooting period, and a typical EastEnders block is about 10 or 11 days shooting for the, sorry, I should probably clarify, a block is 1 week of episodes. So a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that's a block.
With the
And
same
obviously,
director, each block has the same director on it,
same
right? Okay.
director. You'd have different writers, but you'd have one script editor that also kind of takes ownership of that block, and they come on at the commissioning stage. So after the story document's been published, they work with the writers through that script process. Then the director comes on board, and so that was our kind of opportunity to for me to then know how they're going to shoot it, what is. And kind of iron anything out and what their vision, what their kind of vision is for the block, and then and us to kind of land somewhere where we both agree, hopefully. And then they shoot it, and obviously I'll be kept in the loop of any of what how it's going, and you have progress reports. And then they go into post and they do a director's cut, and then the direct, and then they would do my viewing. And so that brings me back to I'm kind of audience member number one, which is a privilege. Like it really is. And I would give my notes. But yeah, I would often sit there and feel and go, oh yeah, this is, I feel like I'm getting a different experience from what yesterday gave me. It's a slightly different tone, or it's a slightly different, you know, we've gone, it could be a number of things, but what I was always looking for is a different, some degree of different viewing experience. So sorry, it's a long-winded way. So it was about kind of making EastEnders feel EastEnders again. Pace was really key. Stories being given the right amount of time to breathe, but also not feel like too rushed, you know, not too drawn out for the sake of plot. It all needed, I was really keen that everything was rooted in character. You know, character is our USP. That is what the soap's best, you know. It's about complex and flawed characters. You know, I don't think that EastEnders needs bells and whistles. You know, it's not a 9 o'clock drama. It's about character and performance. Detail was really important for me. I'm a bit of a stickler for detail and care and plausibility. And I think, you know, trying to avoid contrivance, like every opportunity and coincidence. And something else that I remember talking a lot about when I started was embracing the history. I was really
Yeah, you could
the
tell.
archive. I was, you know, I think like the other soaps too, we have this rich, brilliant back catalogue, this archive, this history, this reality. Like it's like our lives, isn't it? We all have it in our families. You know, it makes people, I think, feel closer to people's lives than any anyway, because you can lean on it. So I was really keen that we did embrace that, and we didn't kind of ignore that. And because I feel like we do that in our lives, we're kind of often thinking of family and friends, even if they're not necessarily with us right now. And I thought, I also feel that that kind of separates the soaps. You know, it's the other dramas. If you come to a brand new drama that's on whatever network, they don't necessarily have that luxury. And I think the other thing was to keep, you know, production value high and consistently high, and making sure that every component of that production came together cohesively. You know, for example, like the dub, and ensuring that the background sound was believable or plausible, or just it felt like it was a real world, you know, and it didn't feel like a set. You know, it is a set. It is a set. The lot is beautiful, and it's the best set in the world. But it's also making sure the interior sets that are obviously, you know, sets, they didn't, they felt as least like a set as possible. And you can do things, whether it's within with lighting, or you can do it within with the dub, with the sound. So that was kind of step one. And kind of the grammar and the DNA and everything working. I did feel that that was quite an easy fix in story and script, and getting people to kind of do their jobs. And then the second thing was a big blockbuster story. That was what I was really looking for. I felt that we needed that to kind of put us back on the map, and that became the sixth storyline. And I'm sure we'll kind of, I'm sure you've got questions on that. We'll go
We'll
into that.
cover
And then the third thing was the
it.
road to the 40th. That was the third. That was three, which was the road to the 40th. And I didn't have it all kind of mapped out or anything. I'm not going to claim that it what came, what we played in the 40th with everything that you would have seen on screen in February was set up and planned 3 years ago. It really wasn't, but I knew that we needed to start building towards it, thinking about it carefully, doing something like doing something slightly different. You know, there's a the, The 30th was brilliant. I loved the 30th. I
Yeah, it
loved
was.
Tendril Ruti. And they'd set the bar really high. But when you set the bar really high, the audience have an expectation. So it's about kind of, you know, delivering or de and hopefully giving them more and giving them something different. So those were conversations that we were having from the very, very beginning. And you know, to something else, like a new family. I knew that I was going to be bringing in a new family. I think you might want to, we might speak about the night and the Vic, but yeah, that was something that I was always planning on.
Right. I mean, so your first sort of appearance on screen as executive producer, I mean, it's not bad for a first episode in terms of guest actors. You bring in half the royal family. That's not bad going for a first episode. Can you sort of talk about how some of that came into play? Was that something that they approached you with, or the BBC wanted it, or?
You know what? I can't take full credit for that. Conversations were already in motion when I came on board. So I remember in one of my interviews with the BBC saying that the Queen's Platinum Jubilee is like on the horizon. We should be trying. I remember saying we should be trying to get William and Kate in Walford, and then they told me that conversations were already early days, but ongoing with the palace. And I was like, oh, brilliant. So I think initially, to be honest, I don't know. I don't know who approached who, and I think it was the BBC to us somehow. I think I'm not entirely sure. All I knew is that it was very likely when I came on board, we were having those conversations with their team, and it was early days. But and initially, actually, yeah, initially they were just going to be coming to do an off-screen set visit to meet the team, which is what they did after. Well, and they kind of greeted everyone, and I introduced them to the entire team, which was brilliant. But then we pitched that we would like them to visit Albert Square. And what we quickly realized is that due to their time, but also not expecting them to act, they're not performers, they're not actors. We only and you know th so there were lots of conversations, but what we realized and decided on that if we were going to do this, we had to do it in one. Like, we had one shot at it, literally one take. And that is a very different way to how we would normally work. Actually, it's like the live episode, isn't it? That you have one take, you have one shot. Well, actually it's not. It's not, because at least with the live, we rehearsed it over
Rehearse,
and
yeah.
over and over again until we
Yeah.
were refined and spot on. Whereas we didn't have the now King and Queen rehearsed.
Yeah.
So it was literally just one shot at it. And we weren't going to be able to ask them, like, go again. So I kind of realized that we were going to need to shoot it as if it was what we call an as live production. And so a few of us, so it was myself, it was my series producer, my line producer, the first director. We didn't have a director on board at the time. And we went to witness a real meet and greet, and we shadowed Charles and Camilla with their help from their team, obviously. It was all set up and arranged, although I'm not sure that the two of them knew that we were there. And we watched very closely how it works, how they conduct a meet and greet when they go to a town or a village or a city. And we watched them really closely to ensure that when they came to Walford, it was no different for them, but also so that we knew how to cover the action, how to cover the scene, how to shoot the scene in one shot. And I then I brought back the maestro, that is Michael Owen Morris, who is one of EastEnders' greatest directors, but he retired a few years ago. So I brought him out of retirement. He can shoot multi-camera in that way, and was able to we shot it from the scanner truck in the same way that we did the live episode. And I can't remember how many cameras we had. How many did we have? I think for the live we had, I want to say 20. What did we have for the live? Now it's gone out of my mind. But 26 for the 40th. I think we must have had. So usually on a EastEnders block, we have three, four if you're doing like a
Oh,
big
wow.
day.
Oh, that's quite a lot
We
then.
probably had about 12 to 15 cameras. I probably got that wrong. And it was ours. I don't know if you remember the episode,
Oh, yes.
but we were doing our last run through in the morning, and they were arriving in about an hour, I think. And it snowed about an hour before they were due to arrive. And they called their team called, and they said, "Is there any possibility that we could move it inside? It's snowing." And we were like, "Oh my gosh, like that's impossible to do because it's such a it was if you remember the scene, there was a big design number. It was all outside the vehicle. Almost like so many of the cast, so many of the crew. It's unfortunately we're nimble and we're flexible, but we're not able to kind of turn that around and put like it would take again like a lot more rehearsal, like days of rehearsal to get that into any kind of shape that you could shoot the scene." So we obviously had to say no, that's not possible. And they were brilliant to work with. Honestly, they were phenomenal, incredibly professional and lovely people to work with. And then they rocked up and the car came round and they yelled action and I was in the scanner and I was like, oh my gosh. And it wasn't live, but we still only had one shot. And then the sun came out, which was brilliant. And yeah, it was a really, really special day. And it was a moment that I think everyone there, everyone in Elstree, will remember. And like I said, they met the entire team afterwards. And yeah, it was looking back, not even just looking back, even at the time, I remember it was a real privilege, a real honor. And yeah, I think it's things like that that make you realize just how important EastEnders as a show, as an institution is to kind of cultural fabric of this country. Like I think, yeah, so it yeah, it's very, very, very special and something. Yeah. So like, I won't take all the credit at all of the beginning of those early conversations. It was already in motion when I started. But yeah, and that's probably why you picked up on it. So I was credited on that episode because I was involved in the execution of it and the producing of it. And then I kind of was taken off the credits and until my first episode actually played out,
A
because
few
they came
months
to me and
later,
said, "Oh, we think you've done so much work on this episode, Chris. We think you should have a credit." And I was like,
if
"Okay."
you insist. So, talking about some of your first moments of being executive producer, one of your first storylines was about loving and losing Lola, which obviously received a very positive audience reaction. Can you explain the development process for it, and was there a reason you picked Lola in particular to be that character?
The development process. I knew I was looking for a big blockbuster high concept story with a difference, which became The Six. And I knew we were bringing a new family into the Vic, which became the Nights. And I knew we were bringing Cindy Beale back from the dead. Although at that point, I don't think she wasn't linked to the Nights. She wasn't linked to the Vic. She wasn't linked to the new family. They didn't have a name at one point. And I also knew that we were losing Mick, which was going to be a big exit and a huge kind of spectacle of an exit. And I felt that there'd been, a few sensational deaths more recently. And I felt that we needed a story that wasn't noisy in the same way, but showed that we can deliver something very sensitive and something very true and something very grounded and something that to some degree every one of us can relate to. I think it's fair to say that we all know someone, or we all know what it's like to lose someone. And it's interesting that you've said in your question, or you've referred to it as loving and losing Lola. And I labeled it that. I called it that, as opposed to Lola's brain tumor. And it was because while EastEnders, we have a rich, proud history of telling hard-hitting medical stories, we were mindful to never let the condition itself, but rather the human dealing with it, be at the center of the story. And kind of at the core of it was a love story. It was a love for her daughter. It was a love for her partner, Jay. It was her love for her family and her community that loved her. And that deep love that everybody had for that young woman. And it was designed purposely to be a story of love triumphing overall and a story through which we wanted
Yeah.
to examine and celebrate the value of life, albeit one that's tragically cut short. I don't know if you remember the kind of very final episodes, and we saw when we saw her health really kind of
Yeah.
deteriorate. I remember at the time there was a really, it kind of struck me, the headline. I think it was in the, maybe the week after, or that night, maybe, I'm not entirely sure. And it said it was like some of the most harrowing, realistic scenes rarely seen in a soap. And I was really kind of pleased with that and proud, actually, because that's kind of what we were aiming for. It was to ensure that Lola's story was always rooted in realism. I think, you know, some may have wanted or expecting Lola to, you know, even though she looked weak, you know, she was still able to say some kind of like farewells, or, you know, say her goodbyes to Billy or and Jay. But I was quite keen that, unfortunately, it's not always, it doesn't always look like that. It doesn't always work like that. It's not as neat and as pretty and as perfect and as sometimes it's depicted in drama. And so we opted out of having that kind of artistic license and choosing to show the reality, I suppose, all the way through to the very end instead. You asked why Lola, didn't you? So I feel that's probably is very important to answer. Yeah, so I think when we were coming up with the story, I think I was really struck by some of the real life stories that have been kind of shared, you know, such as the wanted singer, Tom Parker, who was diagnosed with brain
Yeah,
tumor,
of
the
course, yeah.
podcaster Deborah James, who, you know, faced a terminal cancer diagnosis. And they brought this, I think, fresh understanding of and an awareness as they heroically shared their journey and showed the kind of joys and the devastation, I suppose, all the way to the end. And so I kind of always knew that it was going to be incredibly heartbreaking if it was with one of the younger characters,
Yeah.
the young mother in particular. And
Yeah.
if I'm being completely honest, I knew that Danielle Harold could deliver and
Yeah.
going to be
Oh,
able
didn't
to
she?
hit every emotional beat pitch perfectly. And I also knew that central to the storyline, who would also deliver, you know, those incredible moving performances and do the story justice, which is what it needs if it's going to be a success and if it's going to touch the viewers in the way that you hope. And again, Danielle was surrounded by Jamie Borthwick and Perry Fenwick and Emma Barton, Max Bowden, and not least Isabella Brown, who delivered a
Yeah.
stand as a young Lexi. And yeah, so that's yeah. I don't know if that's a yeah. So that was a huge part of the reason. You have to have a lot of confidence and faith in the cast member and the performer who's going to be able to deliver that in the most truthful way. And I remember at the Soap Awards. It was the Soap Awards in what 2022, and none of my work hadn't started on screen. And Dan, I not long. So Danielle knew that this, we were planning the story, so she was very aware of it. I think it had already been leaked to the press. It was already in the press, and I think a lot of people were obviously very shocked and outraged, and I remember receiving a lot of messages, and I think maybe a lot of people thought it was going to be a sensational death, and obviously they had a huge love for Lola, and you have to do the character that you love.
Of course. Yeah.
Can't do it with a character that people don't care about. And I
Yeah.
remember at Soapwoods, and I set myself up for a fall, and I knew what I was doing, but I whispered to Danielle that it would be her up there next year winning an award.
Wow.
And a year later, she was, and
She
she
did.
walked away with, you know, best leading performer, and she won a trick, and she won the NTA for best serial drama performance, which Steve won this week,
Yes.
and she won the Inside Soap Award, and, you know, she cleaned up. And yeah, it's going to make me sound very smug, I realize that, but I had every faith and that she would deliver, and that's why I gave the story. And I think maybe one might think that me whispering in her ear that she's going to be up there next year was crass, but like Danielle and I, get on like a house on fire, and I completely admire her professionalism. I really do. She's absolutely a star, and we worked really closely for almost a year, and we had to have that trust. But I think she would agree that actually, and you know, it's not just Danielle. It's kind of it's everyone. Like it's the production. Like you're all kind of aware of where you're heading or where you'd like to head. You want to you're aiming high. You've got I'm not going to sound awful, but I have like what's I've got like high expectations or like I'm striving for the best. And that sounds
Yeah, it doesn't, because
awful.
that's what you got. That's what we as viewers got in response to that, Chris. It was
Well, I'm trying to deliver you guys the
yeah.
best. So I suppose my point is that by saying that to Danielle, or by saying that to the team as well, you know, in the story conferences, to the writers, to the editorial team, and to the directors, it's not. I don't see it as a negative to kind of give people that kind of this is what we're aiming for here. This is an award. This should be an award-worthy storyline, and that's what we want. That's what we're hoping. But we've got to deliver it. We can't just say those things without kind of and. You know, it's not easy to like the other shows are, you know, firing on all cylinders, and everyone's doing their best work. So it's not an own goal. It's an own goal. It's not an open goal in any way.
One of the big things in the Lola storyline, and you've kind of already answered this because we know what a fan you are of the show, but one of the it was you gave us the first two-hander that the show had done since I think it was 2018 when Linda and Stuart had one,
Yeah,
and
which
with
I was the
Emily.
story. I story produced that one.
Yeah, I mean, we had been championing for a new two-hander for what felt like years and years and years, and then we finally got the one with Jay and Lola. He then gave us another one with Patrick and Yolandi, which was also incredible. So was that something that you were very keen on doing, or how does a two-hander sort of come into the pitch or the schedule of the story?
I mean, yeah, EastEnders have got a rich history of doing two-handers, and I wouldn't like to kind of say why there'd not been one for a few years. But I think when you look at all of the two-handers over the years, when you go right back to the first one, what was the first one? Is it
Angie and Den, I think it was.
Ian Den? Exactly. You have to have the story, and in terms of you, and you have to go, yeah, we've really earned this, you know, and the audience are going to be really rooting, and the audience are going to care, you know. The what's great about soap is it's an ensemble, and we have multiple storylines, and you get a bit of everything, and you've got tonal balance. And I kind of describe it as a bit of a box of chocolates. Like you can have a thriller, a high concept, like, you know, a who done it over there, and then an issue-led storyline over there, and that is what is so great about the genre. But then sometimes you want to kind of put something under the microscope and the time it deserves. So if you talk about those two-handers, Jay and Lola, Yolandi and Patrick, they were heavy storylines that we were at a certain point in the story. And you know, it wasn't like it was there were organic conversations. And if you take the Yolandi and Patrick two-hander, for example, it kind of was born quite organically, I think. I think it was pitched, but it was pitched. Oh, Patrick and Yolanda doing a two-hander would be brilliant to see these two actors, you know, on kind of prime time television taking center stage. And I completely agree with that. But it's like, well, where do you put it? And you can't just put it on a random beat. And it felt like the right opportunity was when Patrick was going to discover the truth. And I personally don't want to cut away from that. I personally want to stick with that, because what's frustrating sometimes is when you've got a brilliant episode or you've got a brilliant story and you're cutting away to something that doesn't stand up, all you want to be is back there. You're kind of go, get me back, get me back, get me back. So really, they've all got to kind of stand up and have equal, not equal weight as in size of story, as in like an A to a B in terms of the weights of story, but it just in terms of of how much you're invested and how much you care and how much you're intrigued and interested and want to kind of continue to watch. So you've got to have the right story at the and you have to have the right point in that story. And again, going back to Jane Lola, it felt right that this beautiful Margate episode where they were going to have one last moment between the two of them, that was so slight and so tender, full of love, and I just didn't want to go anywhere else. I just wanted to focus on those two characters, like the soaps, and I'm going to say EastEnders. It's the closest thing to theatre. I kind of call it the working class theatre, and you feel that from the very beginning, I think. And the two-handers play into that. One sometimes one set. I think in the Yolande and Patrick one, we went outside once, and then we went from the kitchen and the living room. We went into the bedroom. Do we go anywhere else? The toilet, maybe. Anyway, and obviously the Jay and Lola one was different because it was on location, so we did go to different sets. But there is a kind of claustrophobic nature to it. You sometimes are in those four walls or three walls if you're on the stage, and that was also what, and I know we'll probably talk about the 40th in a bit, but that's kind of what I was striving for with the live episode in the 40th with Stacey and Martin. The point was that it was like they didn't move from that one set. And it was as close to a two-hander as it possibly could be. But because it was the 40th, I also wanted to involve all of the cast, and that's the community. And obviously, we also wanted to, add some levity and have that, kind of play the Sonia storyline with baby Julio. So it wasn't a two-hander at all, but that storyline was conceived in a way for it to feel very small and focused, and so that you were really, really, really close to Stacey when she lost Martin.
So you mentioned the Knights, and we'll sort of talk about the Knights in a sec. But first of all, the Vic was already had somebody in it, which was Mick. So you had to sort of be behind Mick's exit and also Janine's exit as well. Pleased to play with Janine just a bit before she went, I bet.
Honestly, Charlie is fabulous, and
She's my
yeah, well,
favourite character.
is
She's
she?
yeah, I love
She's
Janine.
glorious, isn't she? And
Yeah, she's amazing.
she can get
Murder.
away with everything. Everything.
Literally.
She can get away with anything, unlike a lot of characters. Most characters can't get away with what she gets away. She's absolutely, phenomenal. Yeah, she's brilliant.
So the big question, obviously Mick went in the sea. You're the guy that sort of was in charge of the whole episodes. The big question, is Mick dead?
That's a difficult question to answer, I think. And I don't think it's really for me to say or for me to answer. I very purposely played Mick's exit in the way that we did so that there were options. And importantly, there was hope for the viewers, hope for the future. And I know Danny's spoken publicly about this, and he said that he wanted to die, he wanted us to kill off Mick. And I didn't, and that's true. And we had lots of conversations, and we went back and forth for weeks and months. And but I didn't think it was right for the viewers. He's one of the most iconic characters in recent years, and Dom and Danny and Kelly and the wider editorial team created. What they created with the Carters was something I think was very special, and with Mick, and I didn't think the viewers deserved to have that completely kind of ripped away from them forever. I thought the hope of Mick Carter returning, potentially returning one day, was better than cutting that off, cutting the hype off completely. I think the idea that Mick could be out there and could return is a better one, personally, I think, than no Mick at all. And it's the same with like a character like Grant. Like, knowing Grant is out there and could return is a much better feeling than if he were dead and there was no more Grant. I think that's personally why. So I always knew that it was going to be, to answer your question, a decision for one of my successors. And you know what? An exec producer may decide to kill Mick Carter off screen, and that could happen. And I personally think that would be a shame. Or an exec producer, you know, may decide that they'd like Mick to return one day. And so leaving it in the way that we did, those options are still on the table. And yeah, I felt that that was the best decision for the viewers at the time.
Fair enough. Open-ended. He may still turn up at the door with a bit covered in seaweed one day. It might happen. I mean, to be fair, Chris, you know, you would be surprised what the viewers will accept in terms of, you know, returning from the dead. You know, we've all got our fingers crossed for the sisters returning one day. You never know.
Still.
You never know. So yeah, Mick had gone, which meant that there was vacancies in the Vic, and so arrived the Knights. Now, what was the sort of creative process in the Knights? Like, you had obviously the brilliant Colin Sam coming in, Harriet Thorpe. How did the Knights come to be?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was all born from Danny's decision to leave. That kind of inspired it. I was informed before I started. I think it was while I was going through my interview process that Danny had made that decision. I therefore had this opportunity to take the Vic in a different direction. I knew that I wanted to keep Linda in the Vic and behind the bar. I didn't want to lose her from being the landlady. And so we looked at building a new family around Linda, and it evolved from there. And obviously Elaine already existed, and yeah, the Knights were born. And then in another part of the forest, we were already planning to bring Cindy Beale back from the dead after 25 years with Ian, because he wasn't part of the show at the time either. He wasn't part of the show when I took over, and we were working out what that would look like. And I was insistent that we needed to make sure the story worked if we were going to bring Cindy Beale back. You know, people are probably going to throw things at their computer when I say this, but I'm not really a fan of retconning. And while I appreciate some might argue that bringing Cindy back from the dead is a retcon, I think the story we conceived logically did logically make sense and worked with the off-screen timeline. And you know, there is this unwritten rule in soap that if you don't see the body, then you know. So we were developing the Knights at the same time we were working out how to bring Cindy back. And it was my story producer Rory at the time, and he went away, and then he came back, and he had the idea of putting those two stories together, the two clans, and so we would therefore have this mystery to who George Knight's missing ex Rose was, and it would be, you know, an explosive reveal when the viewers discovered that who is Rose or where is Rose was revealed to be Cindy Beale. And you know, and just kind of going, like, I know that, and I probably said something that I'm going to sound like a hypocrite. It did rely on a huge dollop of coincidence. Like, I completely own that. And you know, that's something that I was always striving for, that our storytelling wasn't contrived to make the plot work. And we would work really hard on that, on smaller plot points, just to make each character's journey more complex and believable, plausible. But yeah, I'll admit that I thought the coincidence with the Knights, that they would end up on the same square that Cindy Beale used to live on, was one to live with, or one we could accept. I think if the storyline is good enough and compelling enough, I hope that the viewers will accept the coincidence in soap. So that's how that storyline came about. So Colin was brilliant. And did I cast him first? I think I did. Yeah, I did. I cast him before Harriet. And I remember not telling him that it was Cindy. I told him the story, but without telling him who at the beginning. But yeah, Colin was absolutely brilliant. We'd spoken about a couple of other things in the past, but they weren't quite right. And you know, if you're gonna have a Hollywood actor in the show, you want him kind of in the and he was perfect for George. He was, you know, he really was perfect for what we already had on paper. And I think he really kind of I don't know about related, but reacted really well to the character. And then we had to find Gina and Anna. We knew that their dad was Colin Salmon. We knew that their mum was Cindy Michelle. Yeah, so that's how that came about.
I mean, and before we just move on to Cindy, I do just want to say the Knights gave me one of my favourite episodes throughout your whole era, which was that incredible episode set at night with the reveal from Eddie and Gloria. It
Oh,
was just all set in the
yeah.
Vic. That episode was phenomenal. You should have won an award just for that episode. It was
That
amazing.
was one of the awards that one of the awards one of the episodes that we put forward for BAFTA that we were, we obviously were we won earlier this year. So that was one of the, and it won best episode at the Radio Times Awards as well that year. Have I got that right? I've got that
You've had
right.
so many awards, Chris. It's easy to forget how
Oh, I
many
have
you
got
got in
that.
the end.
I have got that right because Colin wasn't there to accept it and I accepted it on his behalf and blah, blah.
Right.
Yeah. Best episode. I mean, yeah, phenomenal. And Gloria and Eddie were, I loved that. I loved those characters.
I tell you what, the one thing we said that we thought, oh, Gloria died too early. I was obsessed with Gloria. She was a fascinating character. She really was.
So we've been talking about Cindy and her return, which was one of the biggest soap twists, arguably, of the decade. How did you go about approaching bringing Cindy back? Was Michelle Collins on board straight away? And how did you feel when the press leaked it a week early? Was that disappointing, to say the least?
So I touched on Cindy and the kind of the story and the
Yeah.
connection with the Knights. I mentioned that Ian and the fact that Adam left the show, wasn't in the show when I took over. And I kind of personally struggled with that as a viewer. I think Ian Bill is EastEnders, and EastEnders doesn't feel like EastEnders without Ian Bill. It's a bit like bacon without eggs, or a better analogy, that's awful. It just doesn't feel like it works. And I was keen to get Adam back, which, wasn't easy. He was really enjoying his time away and working in theatre. But I pitched him the idea of bringing Cindy back first, just very loosely, very loosely. And it was shortly before I met with Michelle. So I was meeting Michelle. It was already kind of planned in the diary. But I'd had a meeting with Adam like a few weeks earlier or a couple of weeks earlier, and then I and yeah and then and even though at the time he was enjoying things, I could see that he, I don't know, I don't want to speak for him or but I could see it landed to some degree. And I pitched the story to Michelle, and which was really heavily about the Rose storyline and about the Knights and about her daughters and about the time away and about what had happened and about Lucy and all of that, and her kind of jaw was on the floor, and it was lovely. And I think, I think she'd been asked before. I think, don't quote me. I think she, Michelle will know. I'm pretty sure she's told me that she'd been approached to return before, but it was never the right story or the right reason. And with so yeah, so we revealed Cindy was alive in June 2023, and. You remember when we saw remember when we saw Ian at Doc's funeral? Like nobody, not the press, hardly anyone at EastEnders knew that that was coming. We had this like guerrilla style crew that like rocked up, shot it in 15 minutes. Adam was in, I want to say, Dublin or Belfast at the time, shooting in a play. He flew straight in. He flew back straight back for that night's performance. And Adam was the only person at the time who knew who was on the other end of that phone, on the other end of the phone. Remember, because he takes the call and he says, he gets a call and he says, "I think I'm coming home, love," something like that. And what knew that that was Cindy, but nobody else did. So yeah, to answer your question about Cindy's return being leaked. Yeah, so it was a front page story on a Saturday. I remember being in the office, and I think we got wind the night before, I want to say, but I remember speaking to Michelle on that Saturday morning. This is going to sound a bit melodramatic, and but it was heartbreaking, if I'm going to be really honest.
I bet.
No, we're not saving lives, and we're not curing cancer, or we're not running into burning buildings, but we are trying our very hardest to entertain, hopefully, millions of people. And we care and we take that seriously. And the work that had gone into trying to keep it under wraps so that we could give the audience the surprise of the century. That's a big statement, but as you said, like a big soap twist and a shock reveal, and yeah, it was hard. It was soul destroying, and it was a huge shame. It was it, for
It
all of us
was.
involved, and most importantly, the audience. I remember that. I think
Yeah.
it was ruined for a lot of the audience. Not everybody sees those announcements or those leaks or those stories, but a large proportion do. And unfortunately, it was a shame. Like the Kathy reveal at the for the 30th anniversary. Shocked the nation, and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And it paved it with Cindy and that happening, it did pave the way for, I think, future decisions that some that you'd like to have kept a secret, you decided you were going to announce because you didn't have the confidence that it wasn't going to leak. And so you try to therefore, get ahead and be in control of your own narrative. And yeah, I remember when that happened, thinking that we would never be able to keep anything big a secret ever again.
You certainly managed it.
Well, I was also like really aware and nervous about what was to come, and it's why when we did our monthly, so there was like from September to February, there was I think pretty much a big return every month in the build to the 40th. And I think we announced most of them. We didn't announce the cameos. We didn't announce Joe Wicks. We didn't announce Jake Moon. We didn't announce Mickey Miller. We didn't announce Gary and Minty. And of course, the biggest one that, the cherry on top, we didn't announce Angie. But I was so nervous about it. And especially Angie, but also Martin. Martin was, killing Martin on the 40th was, it was really, really, really incredibly and crucial that that didn't leak either. And I knew that we weren't ever going to be able to keep the fact that the Vic explodes a secret, and I didn't want to. I thought that was great for people to know that this big event was happening and it was going to involve the majority of the community. But I really didn't want it to get out that Martin Fowler was going to die in the live episode, and it didn't. I think through the week, by the end of the Wednesday, the hour-long Wednesday, the cliffhanger, him being trapped under the girder, didn't look promising, but that's fine. That was the design of the storyline. But yeah, and we didn't announce Nigel, actually, and I wanted that to be
I think Nigel leaked as well. I think Nigel, yeah, he did.
I wanted that to. No,
Nigel
you're
was an
right.
amazing moment. But then to be fair, I think Nigel was announced within sort of talk about the 40th. So when he turned up on Christmas Eve, it was still a big surprise. It was like, oh God, it's
Yeah, it
Nigel.
didn't. Yeah, they didn't have many details, which I was pleased about. So they didn't know when or how or why, and I wanted it to be a Christmas Eve treat, because
He
he
looked like
looked
Santa.
Santa with his white beard. But yeah, that did leak ahead of time, annoyingly. Have I answered?
In the next part of Albert Square After Dark talks to Chris Clenshaw.
Chris talks the six.
Tell me whether this was true or not. There was the word six was carved into a
Yeah.
tree, and we were absolutely, was that deliberate? Was were you just throwing in red herrings at that point?
Yeah, who's
Wow.
that?
The returns.
Angie was the cherry. She was the
Yeah,
like
of
the
course.
cherry on the top. And
And the path to the 40th.
I remember Lacey. I remember knowing what we had planned, but it was early-ish days, and Lacey coming to me and telling me that she was pregnant. And since that, she's told me that at that moment, apparently, I went white.
Bet you did.